Welcome to another instalment of the Evolution Exchange podcast. Today, I'm joined by Mark Strand, Ermus Amasep, and Peter Grunland to discuss what is the role of a CISO. Before we delve deeper into the topic, we'll work our way around the room with some introductions. So, Mark, would you like to kick us off?
Well, I'm Mark Strand. I've been working in the security industry and tech since the mid-90s. Been a CISO for the last, 15 years. And of those, I'm right now at Miro, a popular collaboration tool that many of you might have found during COVID. And prior to that, it was two banks. And last time it was Klarna.
Nice. Perfect. Thank you. Ermus, would you like to introduce yourself next?
Sure. My name is Ermus Amasep. I'm the head of information security at Epiroc, which is a spinoff from Atlas Copco about 6 years ago. So we work very much in the mining industry and the construction industry and sell machines and services and whatnot to them. Previously, I've been the CISO at Clas Ohlson, retail company here in the Nordics, and also Delaval, another old Swedish industrial manufacturing company, but in the dairy industry. And then a bunch of years in consulting with information and IT security as well. So I'm also old enough to have been working with security since mid-90s.
Nice, perfect. And then finally, Peter.
Yes, my name is Peter Granlund. I'm the Chief Information Security Officer for If PNC, meaning Property and Casualty. So we're the largest property and casualty insurer in the Nordics and Baltics. And that entails car insurance, home insurance, personal injury, etc. So I've been also in the industry for quite some time, had the CISO position for about 10 years now, 5 years in this current company, 5 years in the financial services sector. I've done some security consulting before that and also have a background in the telco sector where I started in the mid-90s.
Lovely.
Hi everyone, this is Chris Bennett here, the Nordics Managing Director here at Evolution. We're committed to doing recruitment in a different way that adds value to both our clients and candidates by providing you with amazing speakers and leading edge discussions on what's going on in the tech scene at the moment. There are three reasons why you should contact me. If you would like to speak on a future podcast, if you are interested in hiring awesome tech, data, product or gaming freelancers for your business, or if you are looking for an exciting new organization to work with, please get in touch. Thank you so much for listening, and I really hope to hear from you soon. Please enjoy the rest of the podcast.
Now that we know all of you a little bit better, we'll get stuck into the questions that you've all prepared. So as usual, we'll make our way around the group, asking your questions and giving your thoughts about our topic of what is the role of a CISO. So Mark, your question is up first, and you asked, how can CISOs be more relevant to the business, more of a business driver than a business enabler? So tell us a bit more about your question.
Well, it's more for food for thought. Many times I've worked with different security departments and CISOs that define themselves as a business enabler. And there's a quite significant difference between being a business enabler and a business driver. And then if you follow all the conversations that, well, have been going on for basically the last 10 years around, is a CISO really an executive? Is it on par with the CFO or the chief operating officer or any of the other executive roles? What is the key difference? And my question is, what does all of those others do? And what do CISOs do? And then comes the question, how do you become more of a business driver than a business enabler, which I believe the other roles have more of their focus towards?
Well, I would argue that, I mean, to be a business driver, you need to find the parts where cybersecurity is something that's absolutely necessary for the business. The business doesn't necessarily understand it originally. But if you look at the world I'm coming from right now, industrial and manufacturing towards mostly the mining industry, cybersecurity is basically where safety starts, because the whole industry is moving to more autonomy. So you have autonomous vehicles driving down in the mines and the quarries that open. And if that one turns left when it's supposed to turn right, it's probably because of some kind of cyber error, if you will. It could be an attack, it could be, you know, bad programming, something. So cybersecurity is absolutely crucial. And if we don't lead the way and have security as a competitive differentiator, it's going to be hard for us to compete.
So is that an inwards question, or like, is that a question about building those capabilities inward, or is it also outwards?
Both ways, I'd argue, because first of all, you need to make sure that you have real quality products in-house, but you also need to talk to the customers and you have to make them understand that they can trust you from a cybersecurity point of view. So you need to become a trusted partner. It's a lot of communication, both internally and externally. And that's something as a CISO you need to drive, I believe, because the business usually doesn't come asking for it until it's too late.
Yeah, if I go back to the kind of the original question, business driver or enabler, I see the CISO more as a business enabler than driver. And for me, a driver is someone that has an accountability for reaching a certain set of objectives. They are supposed to actually take on risk, etc. While the CISO role is more in actually educating those business drivers, what type of risk they are actually taking on in terms of digital risk and maybe digital resilience as a new buzzword. And I think that is kind of where the position should be. It shouldn't be driving risk. It should actually be educating the stakeholders, ultimately the board, where you foresee that here you're actually running more risk than you have actually expressed the appetite or tolerance for. So I think it means that business should relate to the CISO. The CISO should not be heading the department of no, like we did maybe in the past 2-3 decades. More like the department of yes, but we need to actually be in control of the risks. So that means that as a CISO, you need to understand your business, you need to understand the process, you need to understand the strategy, what you are executing in order to actually deliver upon that strategy, and what type of risks that you may run into during that course of action, and make sure that the language you're speaking to the business stakeholders is clear. So that's kind of where I'm coming from.
Do you have risk manager or risk owners in your insurance business? I assume you have people who basically are sitting there calculating the outcomes, the probabilities, and those aspects to all of your insurances, basically.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, we have underwriters and actuaries who's actually experts at that calculations. And of course, that much of that is based on history. So they have historical data they can make predictions on. But also when we talk about, I mean, our area, our field of expertise being a part of the operational risk, this is much more dynamic. And I mean, the type of cyber and digital risks that we are facing and have been facing for, I would say, the past 10 years or so, when cyber attacks started to become more and more common, we started to see more ransomware attacks hitting private companies, even manufacturing companies that prior to that didn't foresee that they were an attractive target for a criminal. So in terms of risk owners, that is, I think, that the challenge in many organizations to tie this to driving your business processes, evolving your business models, building more digital services to service your customers, but also as a part of that, understanding that you need to actually focus on security and continuity if you want to have a stable platform that you're actually building your processes and services upon.
So that leads me to the question of if your underwriters and those who calculate the probabilities, and they are probably the people that also would tell, like, okay, we need to kind of add this text in the legal agreement with our customers, or this is basically this is how much the premium should be for this group of customers? Do they also give suggestions of opportunities?
I'm not sure they are, but definitely, I mean, in terms of underwriters, a part of that is following up on the claims and looking at where did things go wrong. Did we price this risk inadequately? Did we not have the right terms and conditions? What can we learn from that? And in certain areas, we haven't been clear on the terms and conditions. We have one opinion, customers have another opinion. And then we need to rectify to be transparent and to be clear. But a part of that is maybe that we have not priced the risk correctly. We thought that it would occur less frequently with a smaller hit every time than it actually has proven to do. And we need to recalibrate the way that we actually do this calculation and how we actually deliver the insurance to the customers. But in our field, that is more difficult. I mean, cyber risks is much more dynamic. You have less historical data to base your assumptions on. You need to be faster in reacting to things happening around. And I think that's a challenge for us. If we would have a lot of historical data and things would be fairly stable, we could have much more predictive models on how frequently we are exposed to incidents and what the impact of those incidents are.
But that's the problem. Most companies or organizations want to keep those numbers in the dark.
Yeah. But fortunately, there are regulations coming now. You have the NIS2 directive, you have DORA for the financial services sector, mandating organizations to report this to authorities. So I predict in a couple of years, we will have probably a lot more data on what is actually occurring, because a part of that is also pushing the authorities to actually anonymize this data and actually present it to the sector, so you can actually see how much is actually hitting our part of the universe. But absolutely, I think that's one of the key challenges. We don't really know how frequent this is hitting others and what is the impact for them.
Well, I would argue that information is out there, though it's mostly actually sitting in probably not your insurance company, but in other insurance companies that are working with cybersecurity risk, because they are the one who pay out on cyber insurances and so on. And they have fairly accurate data in order for them to actually offer those insurances for the premiums they are giving them for.
I'm not so sure, because that's why the premiums are so high. They're still struggling partly with calculating those premiums, because they are lacking the historical data they have in pretty much every other case.
And it's getting more and more common to be actually hit by cyber attacks and having impacts from those attacks. So it is a fast-paced environment. I mean, we can think in our profession, this has not been that dramatic for the past 2 or 3 or 4 years, but that is an extremely short period in terms of insurance.
But to back off to your initial question, Mark, where do you put yourself, as a driver or business enabler?
I see myself as more of a business driver. I think that if we take the passive role of only telling others where to draw the line, what risks there are, and then let them take the decisions, that does not enable the business. I also believe that the CISO can actually have a much more, like you were speaking about, go out, talk to their customers, figure out that there is risks and, in that case, opportunities for added functionality or added services that you can then offer towards your customers. I'll give you an example. Like in my past, running a large payment service, working in a large payment service provider, and also a bank, the question frequently came up of like, okay, we want to make sure that you are trustworthy. So figuring out what they really were interested in allowed me to kind of figure out that, okay, our company would actually be benefited by a certification that could actually be leveraged towards the customers, so that we could sign up new customers more quickly. And that was a key differentiator when we did a large expansion in the US, because, well, who knew about that company? Nice Swedish company, sounds nice, oh, you have a banking license in Sweden. Yes, but how can we still trust you? So a certification or an accreditation in this case was actually a business driver then. It was an opportunity to actually get more business. And it was not something that the business came and asked for, but instead something that the security organization identified and proactively went out and got, creating kind of a business driver. And I can tell you similarly in my past experiences when working, for example, at another bank, in those days, there was a lot of banking Trojans. And we could have gone in the same way that everyone else did, having small key fobs. And because in those days, bank ID hadn't become really a big thing. But figuring out that, well, if we actually differentiate ourselves and don't go with the really safe alternative that basically is well established, but still has its flaws, still is possible to circumvent with social engineering, but instead go for the newer technology. Now we can change our entire onboarding process and reduce that number to quite significantly shorter times, lead times. And that can then increase customer acquisition, which in turn drives the business. So having those conversations and having those dialogues proactively with the business allows you to kind of more drive it.
I agree. I've also seen myself organizations that have had similar pain points regarding customer onboarding, where the challenge was actually to build trust with new customers that they wanted to actually hand over some of their most sensitive data to you to provide the service, which they were wanting to having. But you have that kind of tug of war. You still need to trust the service provider that you hand over the information to. And by actually packaging a nice onboarding package and as a part of that being certified to an ISO standard, that enabled the onboarding to go much quicker. The third-party risk management from the client's perspective was much smoother. They had more third-party assurance, and they felt that, yes, now we can trust you because you have this third-party insurance and provide this transparency that you seem to have actually things under control in a way that we can read and interpret. That drives business, absolutely.
Yeah, and if you take that path, then suddenly your conversation with the board also will be centered around opportunities of investing into the security organization so that the organization, the entire company, can actually move faster by promising them, okay, I can do this much better, get more customers in, or let's say we can add a couple of new security features to our product. For example, identifying sensitive information or something like that, and build controls around that our customers can use. Hence, they can much more easily trust us with that sensitive information, and we can do the onboarding quicker or signing quicker, because suddenly the security organization does not have to put in that many compensating controls.
And it also proves that the point earlier that you need to understand your business and understand your pain points and have a discussion with top management. Based on this, I foresee that if we do this, we can reap these benefits over here that we are struggling with currently.
No, but it's all about trust, because we all want to get as much data as we can from our customers, because we can use that to improve our products. We can use that to create new revenue streams by, you know, massaging data through different kinds of algorithms and sell it back to the customers in different ways.
Unless you talk about personal data.
Yeah, well, some of that too, depending on which kind of business you're in. But you know, still, that's what we want to do. Everyone wants to do that. And if you want the customers to start actually giving you the data, they need to trust you, because they're never going to give it unless they really think you can take care of it in a good way.
That's a very interesting conversation, because here I have I see the difference in how you look at that. In our case, we are interested with the customer's data. we never use it for training. We never use it for training models or kind of leveraging that information. We use some metadata around behaviors, around patterns of the customer, more to kind of give them a smooth process or smooth usage of our product, but never use the customer's data, because as soon as, if you're paying for that service, do you really want your the other payment to be in data? So it's kind of like, hey, you paid me X amount of euros for the service, but I also gave you my data to kind of leverage as you see fit.
But if you use that data to give the customer even more value afterwards, so they can increase their, you know, yield in a mine or whatever, there's still going to be an upside to it. And so long as you can find the upside, you're going to be able to do it, because then the customer is going to, this is going to give me value. But however, there's a risk attached to giving that data, regardless of what data it is and on which level. There's a risk attached to it, and that's where the trust part comes in. If you can show through certifications and different kinds of ways that you can be trusted with their data, it's going to be a lot easier to actually do that transaction. But of course, I mean, if, yeah, you're paying us a lot of money, we want your data as well, and you're not going to get anything from it. No, I mean, that's not a serious business proposal.
But you're also then giving it away you're also giving my insights to my competitors. Is that the way that it works?
No, that would not be the way it worked, because that you might want to benchmark, but absolutely not give your one customer's data away to another customer. That would be suicide.
No, I'm meaning the insights from that data. So, for example, if I learn from, do you learn from one mine and learn the usage patterns, how to optimize workloads and stuff, and can leverage that for other customers? Because then you're doing it for yourself. But if you're only doing it for the customer, for example, let's say I have an AI model that's built for you. That one is running for you to kind of optimize your processes. But if that model is also training the model, that data is also training the models for all customers, then it becomes kind of taking data from the customers and leveraging it, not for the customer, but for other customers. And that's a business decision. There's companies that basically do this, like Facebook and so on, that where you are the commodity, you are the data. That's what you pay with.
Yeah, and that's not, I mean, what I envision for our industry in that sense. I mean, there are different ways of doing it, and the whole world is very much more complex than just, you know, a mine. One mine is extremely different from another mine when it comes to, you know, how fast you can drill through the stone, the you know, different kinds of quarries and whatnot. And you can't use necessarily the data from one mine for another one because they're not comparable. But, you know, that's more of a decision on business level, what kind of stuff you want to take from the customers. But if you start using the Facebook model on a business-to-business company like ours or yours, I think you're going to be fairly short-lived on the market.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree. But I know that there's, for example, companies who deal with crops and who deal with equipment for harvesting that will basically leverage that, take that data and utilize it to benefit other customers because, well, that's basically they realize that data is the new commodity as well.
Yeah.
Nice. So that was a really good discussion on that question. So good question, Mark. And Peter, we'll move on to yours next. And you asked, how do you see that the CISO role has evolved since you first got in contact with it? So tell us a bit more about your question.
Well, it's based on me coming into contact with this role about 25 years ago. And from my point of view, at that point in time, the role was kind of, let's say, harder in terms of more focused on technology and hardware and software, while if I look at the position I'm having now, it's quite dramatically different. Now it's much more into being kind of an independent advisor to boards, executives, and key stakeholders, working with softer skills, like how you actually raise the awareness regarding how to manage ICT and information-related risks, and how you actually select what is the best course of action to actually treat the risk. Should it be to mitigate it, avoid it, accept it, transfer it, etc. So from that point of view, I'm just a bit curious to hear how you guys have seen, because you've also been in the business for quite a while and came into contact with similar types of roles, or even the CISO role, about the same point in time as I did.
Well, I can tell you my experience, and I agree with you. This is like it used to be a very technical role, and it used to be there was also I would want to add, there was always kind of an aspect to the awareness training and the employee side of things. But the thing that probably shifted the most since somewhere in the mid 21st century was that, or sorry, that was changed in since 2010, most probably, was how much time we spent on regulations and compliance. That has been a significant amount of change there. And also how much time then in the later years we spend with customers.
And you're basing the regulatory part, I guess, because you have a background in the financial services sector. So yeah.
Well, yes, but also since then, like what have come into play? Like GDPR, they didn't exist before. There was a lot of aspects like that. But in reality, there wasn't much regulations that held you up to any bar. So now you actually needed to understand that much better. And also contracts changed. The legal obligations that you had between different companies definitely changed. I've seen contracts with some very, very large, very well-known service providers in Sweden from the early 2000s. And how different they are from contracts today.
And is that thanks to the CISO being involved in that and over time making sure that the maturity is actually increased?
I hope so.
I would also argue, yeah, probably CISOs at different companies, because you as a CISO, you start setting higher requirements for anyone you want to sign a contract with as well. But I mean, I completely agree with Mark on the regulation and legislation. I mean, it's popping up everywhere, and it's just going to get worse because we're going to have the AI Act, the Cyber Resilience Act, which is going to turn a lot of manufacturing companies on their heads because they're going to have to start doing things they've never done before, because they need to start working like Microsoft with Patch Tuesdays and software bill of materials, finding, remembering which, you know, open source libraries you're using for all your different products. It's going to be a massive shift for very many companies over the next 3 years before it kicks in. So regulation, legislation is a big one.
Maybe we should touch upon what the Cyber Resilience Act entails for the audience.
Yeah, well, basically it states that if you have a product that has a digital part, which means software built into it, you as the manufacturer have a responsibility to patch it for the entirety of its lifetime, the product, and
minimum 5 years.
Also, you need to be fast at reporting any vulnerabilities to, you know, CSIRTs and whatnot, and the different national agencies in all the countries. So, and again, if you're using, you need to have software bill of materials. You need to know exactly what software belongs in this product and make sure that they stay updated and secure. And, you know, Microsoft and Oracle and all these software companies have been doing this for years. Manufacturing companies, not so much. So there's massive change going to happen there. And It's the same thing as with GDPR, you know, massive fines if you don't fulfill the regulation. And again, you don't really know what it's going to look like until probably just before they release it. So we're going to work a little bit in the dark like we do with GDPR before that one kicked in and back in 2018.
And we can add to that. Oh, sorry.
Yeah, my interpretation is that this was intended for things like Internet of Things, baby monitors, webcams, doorbells, etc. But it actually affects a lot of more organizations and types of digital products or products with digital elements. Like I think also you will see in the financial services sector for anyone that releases or actually provides apps to customers for providing login and the internet-based services for banking, insurance, asset management, etc. Those will also be covered by the Cyber Resilience Act.
I think that will also hit the entire supply chain because it's no longer just you providing a piece of software and someone taking the CD or the floppy and putting it in their system. It's more of a service and it's more of a connected service. And then on top of things, you have also other regulations like DORA that has come into effect. And then you will have NIS2 and, well, definitely AI Act. So cybersecurity, the table stakes for cybersecurity definitely has increased. Hence, and in the US, you can even see how that table stakes have also gone all the way over to the CISO role. It's where they are held accountable for how they have represented their security posture and their internal controls.
And even inform the markets on that. Yeah, with the SolarWinds case, with the CISO being indicted by the SEC in the US.
Yeah, but that was because he was trying to hide stuff, though. Well, that's interesting because some people are warned that that's going to move into Europe as well. So you become personally responsible as a CISO for a lot of the company's cybersecurity. That's going to be an interesting development if that happens in Europe as well.
Well, if you take, for example, the security statements that many companies do that you have towards your customers and those claims that you're having. Well, if the CISO is there, then basically that's their accountability of what are you saying outwards towards your customers.
Yeah, but so far, I mean, at least in Sweden, you end up with the CEO having the ultimate responsibility, basically. So I haven't seen a Swedish company sacrifice their CISO yet. Probably just a matter of time.
Well, not from a legal point of view. I think that, that doesn't fly depending upon legislation, but you will definitely see the board being held accountable. And if they have failed miserably with controlling the environment in the organization, you will actually have to replace the board. But it will be an interesting future to see what actually happens. This is a risk increasing gradually. I think also regulators and boards are seeing that, in many organizations, and you can see that in public reports from World Economic Forum, from Allianz Risk Barometer, that cyber attacks is the biggest risk for an organization. It's actually even higher up on the agenda than, for instance, business interruption, which, of course, is a real challenge for a production company. So I think as a part of that, we need to actually strengthen in the way that we govern the cyber risk in organizations. But then you can discuss how much accountability can you put on the CISO? Do they actually have the keys to the kingdom? Do they have the full mandate to actually steer all the money, resources and priorities to defend the position of the organization properly? So that will be an interesting future to actually monitor.
But if the CISO does not highlight those issues or does not correctly reflect what is actually the risks, then I would say, there comes your accountability, which would probably hit. And I think that's where also the case with SolarWinds is that the CISO in that case were not hiding it towards He was hiding it towards the internal stakeholders as well as towards the external stakeholders. Was it his choice?
Then the question comes, is the CISO responsible for managing a risk and also monitoring the risk, meaning supervising their own work? And for that type of work, you typically have internal audits. You have compliance monitoring functions.
That's one thing that I was thinking about. If you go back to the original question, that's changed a lot as well since I got into it, because I've up until now always been information and IT security manager. I've been responsible for both. At Epiroc, I'm the head of information security. So we also have an IT security manager, and we've gone into the three lines of defense model, where the first line is the business, who owns the risk. The operational security is handled by the IT security team, whereas my team is in second line, so dealing with risk management mostly. And then we have the third line, which is internal audit. And obviously, we have compliance people and internal control and whatnot as well that we work together with. But that's an interesting way that you have to look at it as well. How are you actually organized? So as a CISO, would you have that kind of clout? So whatever risk you identify has to be mitigated somehow to a certain level, even if it's not you who owns the risk or is responsible for actually fixing it.
But I think you answered your question there with whether or not, or the question there, whether or not you are the one who monitors, because you're sitting in second line. And per definition, you are the one who has an independent reporting line towards the board. Hence, you are the one who needs to monitor it, provided you have a three lines of defense set up.
Yeah, but there, I'm also very dependent on the internal audit, that they also make sure when they're out there auditing the company that they follow up on the crucial or really important controls. Because otherwise, according to your reasoning, then I would have to be out there auditing as well.
Well, yes. Conducting monitoring activities, and that's maybe slightly different, but maybe not digress into that. But I think it's interesting to hear, and I fully agree that in the good old days, we were padding firewalls and IT security solutions and running awareness campaigns. And now we're more speaking to the boards and working more in risk management and kind of assurance functions, like in this traditional first, second, three lines or third line of defense. So I think the CISO role is shifting more into that type of assurance function and capability, while the operational function is still retained in the first line in IT and in the business.
And that, I think that became very apparent when there came EBA guidelines on risk management for cybersecurity for the financial industries. There, it is very clear and very apparent that, well, the role of the one who leads the information security management system or information security in the company is the one who also needs to follow up and control.
They should be independent, and EBA meaning the European Banking Authority here.
Yeah. Yes.
Nice. Well, we'll move on to one of our last questions, and that is from you, Ermas. And you asked, what's the good, the bad, and the ugly of being a CISO? So kick us off with your question.
Yeah, I kind of went a slightly different way. Instead of looking at, objectively what's happening with the CISO role, it's more like a personal reflection of the good, bad, and ugly of being a CISO. And not necessarily just what you've experienced yourself, but also what you've seen in the business over the years. And I don't know, maybe we should take turns talking about the different parts, but I figured maybe not start with the good, but save the good for last, so we can end on a positive note instead of ending on ugly.
I support that.
But I can start off with one or two, the bad part. So cyber threats don't snooze, so neither do we. So sometimes, it's hard to sleep all through the night if it's very stressful. So I'd say that's one of the bad things. And I can take another one that we discussed just a little while ago, which is compliance frenzy. So you have all.
You stole my one. I was also thinking about that one.
New regulation, legislation popping up all over the world. Just keeping track of what's out there is hard. And just staying compliant is even harder. So you've got the GDPR, the HIPAA, the CRA, the people, the personal information protection law in China, if you have people there, which we do quite a lot, and NIST2 and everything like that. So those are two sleepless nights in compliance frenzy. You guys are more than welcome to fill. I have a few more, but I want to hear yours as well.
I can add the regulatory complexity that lots of regulations with very short time frames to implement, overlapping. I don't think I need to continue, but I think that that's definitely one area. And it's not only hitting us in our field of work, but also many parts of organizations, AI ethics, etc. So, yeah, absolutely. I would add to that also the evolving threat landscape. It goes quickly and it shifts. And it's not so that in a large organization, it only takes a few months to actually change the way you're working or implement new solutions. It takes longer time. So you need to be really on your toes and plan ahead, the way ahead. And I think the last one also, the talent shortage, that it is difficult to attract and retain talent.
I think that the aspect that I would want to add to this is actually a large level of burnout in the industry. You read about it pretty much everywhere. People take their job seriously in security usually, and they take it personally. And they are also very stressed, and there's shortage of talent. You never get all the stuff that you, all the budgets, all the things that you want to do, and definitely don't get the organizations to address everything you want to do. That's the natural pace, especially if you are pushing towards explaining to them to kind of take ownership. The security organization is going to take that to heart, and some of the people who aren't well equipped to handle that are going to burn out.
I had that under ugly.
definitely under ugly, but I would actually move the one that, or for me at least, the compliance aspect of things aren't that bad. To me, that's actually something good, because that means it's important. It means it sets the bar. That bar is preferably common. Yes, you have multiple regulators in multiple different countries, but that's always going to be the different requirements. There's countries out there that uses the metric systems, and then there's the weird ones that uses something based on foots. And
that's pretty much one country, right?
Yeah. But there's the imperial scales. So I'm just pointing out that those differences will always occur. But if you approach it systemically, you can handle all of those compliance requirements. You can address all of them, and you can actually raise the bar, because it's easier to kind of understand also what's required of you, because those regulations didn't come out of thin air. It's not like they come with all of these requirements for no reason.
Typically, it's best practice. You, if you look into, which I've looked into thoroughly, into DORA, the Digital Operational Resilience Act for the financial services sector, it's really difficult to argue that it's actually stupid things they're writing in the regulation. But it is very tough. And also, it is written by one regulatory body, which is actually writing this regulation in a fashion that makes it a little bit of tug of war. You should think risk-based, but you shall implement one-size-fits-all these controls, which doesn't really go hand in hand. And then you have, on top of that, other regulations from the same kind of European entity, which is also overlapping into what you're seeing in one regulation, and then in the second, and in the third. But I agree with you. The regulations are not bad the way they are formulated. There is some common sense that if you're working in a risk-based fashion, and you have good control of what you're doing based on those risks, you should be in a fairly good shape anyway. But those regulations are really detailed that we're seeing now. They're really on a different scale detail than we have seen before.
And you also see many of these being created in a vacuum, where sometimes the regulators are disconnected from the reality of how things work.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
But luckily we have the draft processes in most of these regulations, where also the companies and special interest organizations can actually come back and give feedback to regulations. And being part of that process on several occasions, especially for the Swedish Bankers Association, you kind of saw the difference it could make, wherein, for example, Sweden created new requirements for banks in 2014, but it was so poorly written that it couldn't actually be implemented. The first draft. The second draft was actually quite okay, and that one held for quite some time, until basically European Bankers Association came with new requirements.
I agree that the compliance stuff isn't bad per se, because it does drive better things. But as you say, some regulators are sitting in a vacuum. They are not looking at the other regulations that are already out there from the same entity, basically the EU. So they collide. And everyone needs to have their own kind of version of GDPR, instead of like, okay, this one's pretty good, it's been worked through, let's just copy that. No, we're going to add some other stuff just to make it complex, or especially for international companies. So that's why I put that in the bat, even though I do agree about things getting better with good regulation.
Well, at least it's not as bad as in the US, so where you have different federal governments and then different states that keep giving different requirements that none of them align, and puts a lot of demand on the organizations that are there.
That is true.
There is different degrees in hell. How do we have the Swedish proverb?
Okay, shall we move over to the other? I just want one comment on the CISO burnout, because I actually found some numbers that 73% of CISOs in the U.S. have experienced burnout. A corresponding number of CISOs in the U.K. is 70%. So the numbers seem to be approximately the same across the board. So
yeah, and I have a take on that. And I think it is actually much related to really unrealistic accountabilities put on the CC without any similar matching in mandate, which means that you are basically put in a role that is impossible to actually execute on according to the role description. And I think that is something that needs to be considered by whoever is actually hiring the CISO, and the CISO is reporting to. They need to have a balance between the accountability and the mandate. And I think that is a universal type of balance that you need to have in any role.
Yeah.
And I think that kind of connects it back to my first question. Are you an offensive player or a defensive player? Are you standing in the goal and you're expected to just keep catching the balls? Or are you actually out there to kind of make the play for the team to win? And if you are, I think you have a better situation in the organization to actually push those narratives and push those correct decisions being made.
Shall we move on to the ugly? I have breach fallout. If you get breached, it can get ugly. You're going to PR nightmares, legal battles, and erosion of trust. And worst case, you get another really ugly thing, the blame game. Everyone's pointing fingers. So IT's pointing fingers at CISO, CISO pointing fingers at IT, and it gets really ugly from there. Any other takes on the really ugly parts that can happen?
I think you strike a note here that unclear roles and responsibilities, and with the expectation that the CISO will actually fly in like Batman and solve everyone's day and save the day, even while the Batman is more of a Robin. They're a supporter, they're a sidekick. So I think this probably you have many organizations recognizing what you're raising here. I think another thing to add is volume of reporting, and often reporting for no clear reason. If you do report, it should be for a clear reason. There should be actually a a sensible use for that type of data. Otherwise, it's compliance reporting. And as you mentioned earlier, this I listed on the ugly side is the stress involved, because with all these uncertainties and unclear roles and responsibilities, it only drives stress. And I think that's an ugly part of the role.
Perfect. We're just going to take a little pause whilst Mark's on the phone. I don't want you guys to lose your flow, but you're in it. I'm sure he won't be too long, and we'll just wait for him to come back and we'll continue the discussion. But how are you guys thinking it's going so far?
There's pretty good flow.
I think good flow. I was expecting this to be shorter discussions. But once you get us guys wound up, then we won't stop. We'll just continue.
No, we're just going off on a tangent no friction.
That's the best way to be, though.
We have fresh Duracell batteries.
Good. Well, Mark, we did pause for you. So Peter just finished his points about the ugly. So feel free to kick us off with your thoughts around the ugly side of being a CISO.
I thought we were talking about the ugly side of being a CISO in the very beginning.
It kind of borders into my ugly part. So, I feel you.
So it's kind of like, oh God, that's the difficult. All right. Well, the ugly side I see is where the security organization is not being heard, or where the priorities are not being aligned. And I think this is a language issue, much caused by our industry ourselves, where there is a disconnect between security organization expecting the rest of the organization to actually understand what they're saying and to act accordingly. And that I think is kind of the ugly portion. That's where the ugly portions come out, with kind of misunderstandings and a lot of conflicts that the CISO might need to go in and mediate in and basically explain and set the narrative correctly, so that both sides actually understands. Because I think that's where that's also one of the requirements for a CISO, is kind of understanding the business, as you said, put it very very eloquently earlier, and then to explain it. And you cannot always expect that from the specialists to fully understand and fully grasp the business processes and the business objectives.
Interesting. Because
I actually have this as one of the good parts of the role, that you actually get to be engaged in discussions between business stakeholders and actually IT specialists and specialists in other areas, and actually use your experience and your knowledge about the topic to actually translate and build bridges between different parts of the organization, who I've seen in the past have had quite a lot of challenges with understanding each other.
Yeah,
I agree. I also have that on the good. I mean, you need to translate cyber jargon to the CEO and explain business risks to the techs. That's fun.
It's a challenge, but it is fun when you start to get the knack of it.
I think that those parts are the fun parts as well. But where it gets ugly is through the misunderstandings between the two, between the organization, making where you see that basically is causing conflict, where they are not, where one side is not seeing the business side and the other side is not seeing the security side, and that sitting there and seeing them having that conflict, that's the ugly portion of it. Of course, mediating it is one of the nicer parts of the job.
No, that's the when you get them to actually understand each other, it's that feels like a win.
It can be actually really, really nice feeling when you see the lights really shine at the back of their eyes, that okay, now this individual, they got it, they understood how this relates to what they're doing.
How do you feel about crisis management or incident management?
Waking we try up to in avoid
the
it.
The night.
Yeah, especially Friday nights or Saturday mornings. That's the best one. over Easter or something like that. That's perfect.
Isn't it interesting how people keep tend to if something is going to be reported, wait until Friday afternoon to actually
around
write
3 o'clock.
Up.
Yeah.
Around 3 o'clock
exactly.
To send it in.
I'll just round off the week this way. Yeah, exactly.
Yes. And someone else's week just begins.
Yeah. But the thing is, and I think I'm not alone in this. Because I've heard other CISOs and IT security managers, have this confession that you don't actually want the incidents, but when they do happen, it's kind of fun because everything's on its edge. All of a sudden, you need to work hard, fast, smart to solve the incident. Now, depending on what the incident looks like, it can be really nasty, but somehow when you're in it, it's sort of a thrill.
Yeah, and as CISOs, we know, never waste a good incident. There's an opportunity hiding there somewhere to improve.
Absolutely.
Well, you don't learn anything. The organization never learns as good as from an incident, but the question is how you can create that without the downsides of it, risk. But then I would ask, is it the hero aspect of things or the adrenaline rush, or what is it that you crave?
I think I don't crave it. No, there's a big difference. I don't go looking for it. But when it happens, no, I think it's not the hero aspect, it's more the adrenaline rush and because when you're in an incident, the people you work with, that team becomes very tight-knit very quickly because everyone's working in the same direction and everyone wants to go home because it's probably 10:30 on a Friday night, as you guys said, because that's when the incidents happen on Friday afternoon. So I think it's more that the rush of everyone working together really efficiently towards a common goal.
Well, I used to once upon a time work as to go out to companies that had incidents and breaches as a consultant and go in and help them out. And yes, I really liked the process when I was doing it, but maybe I got over that because when you got to the same customer the third time for the same incident, basically the same vector, you were wondering like, what's wrong with you guys? What do you do here? But also getting down from that adrenaline rush has also its downside. So personally, I'm not that keen on that process. I love it when it goes smooth. You go in, you just basically, okay, these are the facts, this is our actions, and your plan is already in place and it runs through smoothly. That's when I really feel the greatest sense of accomplishment, because then you know that your foundations are good. What you set up all of those other months.
I fully agree. And also the lessons learned afterward, the post-mortem, where you actually try to find out how can we avoid this happening again? Where can we improve and how and make it effective?
And if
you work with a close team, then all is focused on just that. Let's not try to handle the same type of incident again.
And that's the good part about being a CISO or working in the line organization at a company, because as a consultant, you came back to the same stuff every time. As a CISO, you actually have the chance to learn and fix it. And that's another good thing.
So the good part for the CISO is the bad part or the ugly part for the consultant, or could be.
Could be.
Well, you get quite well paid when you're working in incident as incident commander for breaches, I can tell you that, but I don't really think it's necessarily worth it.
Okay. Another, if we go back to the good here, one thing that I'm a tech at heart because that's where I started out back in the day, and there is so much out there, interesting technology. Now everything's getting, a twist of machine learning and AI and stuff like that. There are so many things to choose from and so many smart solutions and, tech development is just on an all-time high. And, you still want to drive platformization. So you don't want to have too many different products to integrate and to not too much hair swiveling. But I think all this tech is part of the fun, the good part as well. Any other takers on that one or something else?
Well, I love the tech part, coming from a tech background myself. My personal favorite is when you see the business actually grow and you see that some of those contributions that you made actually was key to actually making that happen. That to me is where I feel the biggest sense of accomplishment. And then the innovation, probably, because there's still so much room for innovation. This is a space that definitely is keep being redefined continuously. Even though there's more and more tech, there's more and more solutions. And it seems like an endless stream of cybersecurity tooling that keeps coming into the market. But there's then still seems to be ample good enough place for there to be good innovation. How about you, Peter?
Yeah, and I was also thinking about the fundamentals still apply, that you need to understand what you're trying to solve using what the technology brings to the table, how can it be used but also abused, how do you prevent that? So I think even with new technology coming into, I mean, traditional common sense ways of implementing that and handling this. But absolutely, I mean, we're seeing all sorts of new types of business opportunity based on technology that we weren't able to do maybe 10 or 20 years ago, that is now opening up completely. And it will redefine how markets work. It will redefine how security will work in different sectors. And of course, regulations like we talked about.
Nice. Well, we'll wrap up our discussions there. Thank you all so much for taking part of the podcast. I just want to thank you all, Peter, Amas, and Mark, for joining me on this episode. And if you're listening and want to get involved in an episode like this or any other topics, do reach out to me on LinkedIn or by email at abby.stokes-evolution.nordics.com. See you next time.